Today, the Half Full Brigade. Market update for the 7th of August 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's show, we look across the global markets and read the ruins of what's going on. Despite the rise in Delta caseloads, markets are looking through this potential risk, reacting to recent company results and jobs growth that occurred pre-Delta. The glass is, as they say, half full. The S&P 500 and Dow closed at record highs on Friday on the back of optimism over the recovery after data from the US showed the economy created more jobs than expected last month, even if employment is still 5 million below pre-COVID levels. The S&P 500 rose 0.2% and it hit a record intraday high of 4,436. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 0.4% to remain close to its all-time high of 35,208, but the Nasdaq was down 0.4% to 14,835. The US economy created 943,000 jobs in July. That was above forecasts, which were at a gain of 870,000, while the unemployment rate fell to 5.4% from 5.9%. Average hourly earnings rose to 4% from 3.7% as employers were forced to hike wages to attract new workers amid the dearth in labour supply. The trend of rising wages is expected to continue and could keep inflation higher for longer. The bumper payroll report highlighted a roaring recovery in the labour market, and it increases the chances of the Fed tapering their asset purchases sooner rather than later, according to Mike Bell, global market strategist at JP Morgan Asset Management. The stronger jobs report supported investor expectations that the Federal Reserve could begin to trim its bond purchases by the end of the year. In fact, Dallas Fed President Robert Kaplan added to the speculation on Friday, saying he'd support adjusting purchases soon, but in a gradual manner. The Fed should cut monthly Treasury purchases by $10 billion and mortgage-backed securities by $5 billion, ending its bond-buying program in 8 months, Kaplan said, while declining to specify a start date for the process. Such a pace would also mean that the purchases of the two assets would decline in lockstep, as the Fed is currently buying $80 billion per month in treasuries and $40 billion a month in mortgage-backed securities. Some officials have argued for reducing the mortgage purchases faster or first, given the surge in housing prices. I imagine the Fed wants to see another good report like this, but this is going to probably edge them a lot closer to tapering sooner, said Kathy Jones, the chief fixed income strategist for Schwab Center for Financial Research. There's a lot to like here. The jobs data showed continued momentum in the US's economic recovery, and traders will be looking for data on price pressures next week and how hot inflation is running ahead of the Jackson Hole Symposium later this month. This is often where the Fed shows its future plans. The timing for tapering now rides on the August employment report, which could soften in response to the spread of the Delta variant. But tapering is now pretty much baked into the cake by the end of the year, Diane Schwank, chief economist at Grant Thornton, said in a note. Federal Reserve Vice Chair Richard Clarida on Wednesday said the US economy is likely to continue to grow so that the labour market heals and inflation averages above 2%. For long enough so that by the end of 2022, the US Central Bank can begin raising interest rates early in 2023. Given that forecast, commencing policy normalization in 2023 would be entirely consistent with our new flexible average inflation targeting framework, Clarida said in remarks to the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Clarida didn't dwell on the Fed's looming decision on when and how to start to slow the massive $120 billion in monthly asset purchases. And he said the Fed will continue to examine tapering in coming meetings. The plural of the word meetings might be important, as some Fed officials are agitating for a decision at the next meeting in late September. In the question and answer session, Clarida said that if the economy evolves as he expects, I would certainly see myself supporting announcing a moderation in the pace of purchases later this year. We will provide advance notice before making any changes to our purchases, he added. And Clarida focused more on when the Fed might raise interest rates. He said that he agreed with Fed Chairman Jerome Powell's comments last week that a hike in interest rates isn't on the Fed's radar screen. The central bank has adopted a new framework, saying it would aim to achieve inflation moderately above 2% for some time, so that in the longer run, inflation would average 2%. The central bank also wants to achieve maximum employment. Clarida said that these conditions for the first rate hike would be met by year-end 2022, allowing for the first move in 2023, and he expects inflation to be above 2.1% in 2022 and 2023. Combined with the spike in inflation this year, that would satisfy the Fed's condition for inflation above 2% for some time. Seven Fed officials have forecast an earlier liftoff for rising interest rates. With the first rate hike in 2022, and the Fed's so-called dot plot forecast projects a majority of the 19 top officials see two interest rate hikes by the end of 2023. The Fed vice chairman said he sees the recent rise in inflation as transitory, but he added that the risks of higher inflation are greater than the risks of low inflation. If core PCE inflation remains above 3%, that would be higher than a moderate overshoot of the Fed's 2% target that the central bank is aiming for, Clarida said, but he didn't specify if any policy action would be needed. Core PCE was running at around 3.5% in June. That's the highest in 30 years. But Clarida says he favours a different measure, core PCE, starting in February 2020 to smooth out any base effects from the pandemic. This measure of inflation is running at around 2.7% through June 2021 and is projected to remain above 2% in 2022 and 2023, he said. US Treasury yields surged following the report, with 10-year yields rising to nearly 1.3%. Rising Treasury yields, an ally of bank stocks, prompted strong gains in banks such as Wells Fargo, pushing the overall financial sector higher. The finance sector index was at 1.24% on Friday to 616. High interest rates boost the return on interest that banks earn from their loan products, or net interest margin, the difference between the interest income generated by banks and the amount of interest paid out to depositors in the normal course of events, but of course banks are being supported by central banks around the world at the moment. Energy was among the top sector gainers, shrugging off weaknesses in oil prices amid demand concerns from China, who implemented restrictions to curtail the Delta variant of coronavirus. In fact, oil prices are facing a weekly loss of around 6%, which would constitute their most pronounced weekly decline since March. Commerce Bank said data showed weekly US crude inventories unexpectedly increased last week. Stockpiles increased 3.6 million barrels during the week ended July 30th, confounding expectations for a draw of 3.1 million barrels. Oil posted its worst weekly loss in 9 months, as a soaring dollar on Friday hobbled any attempt by crude prices to rebound on Mideast tensions after a week of negative news on COVID. New York traded U.S. West Texas Intermediate crude, the benchmark for U.S. oil, settled Friday's trade down 81 cents, or 1.2%. And for the week, the WTI lost 7.7%. That's the most since the 10% drop during the week of October the 23rd, 2020. Oil and most other commodities tumbled as the dollar sprung back from a recent spate of selling, as a resilient US jobs report for July raised questions about the continuance of the stimulus provided by the Federal Reserve to markets and the economy. Since the COVID outbreak in March 2020, the Fed has been buying treasuries and other assets to that monthly tune of $120 billion to support the US recovery from the pandemic. A stronger dollar will likely prove to be a big drag over crude prices in the short term, said Ed Moyer, who heads research for the Americas at New York-based broker Onda. Crude prices were down for the first 3 days of the week amid a global surge in coronavirus cases from the Delta variant that cast a pall over the outlook for oil demand. In the US, the world's biggest oil consumer, COVID cases hit a six-month high, with more than 100,000 infections reported earlier this week, according to Reuters. Crude prices did manage to catch a break on Thursday on Mideast tensions as Israeli jets struck purported rocket launching sites in Lebanon in response to an earlier attack. That was before the dollar's rebound on Friday, which put paid to any further rebound in oil. But tech stocks fell as rising US Treasury yields weighed on the sector. Google parent Alphabet, Microsoft, Apple, Facebook and Amazon.com were all in the red. And in other news, Virgin Galactic jumped 6% as the company reopened ticket sales for space tourism, with seats starting at a cool $450,000. The company also reported mixed quarterly results as earnings missed, but revenue topped Wall Street estimates. European stock markets traded slightly higher on Friday, helped by positive global sentiment, with the UK's FTSE up 0.04% to 7,123 and the DAX in Germany closing up 0.11% to 15,761. The London Stock Exchange Group reported a sharp rise in first half revenues on Friday, along with progress integrating Data Group Refinitiv and a dividend increase, triggering the best daily performance in its shares so far this year. British Stock Exchange operator LSEG said its total revenue rose 4.6% to £3.36 billion, helped by a 9.6% rise in capital markets revenue, as listings enjoyed their best first half since 2014 and higher fixed income volumes. Shares in the 300-year-old bourse were up 6.3%, marking their best day since December 2020, and topping the blue chip FTSE and also Europe's Stoxx 600. We've had a terrific first half of the year. Capital raising is very robust, and the number of companies have been coming to market, Chief Executive David Schwimmer told reporters, after LSEG said its operating profit jumped to £1.17 billion from £457 million a year earlier. Schwimmer said he expected the rest of 2021 to remain busy for initial public offerings or IPOs and a modest number of special purpose acquisition companies to list. The Bank of England may move a step closer to tightening monetary policy, showing a path towards unwinding almost £900 billion of government bond purchases, while also opening the possibility that borrowing costs could be pushed below zero. While the two decisions pull in opposite directions, they could prove inextricably linked. They feed into the debate about which policy levers the UK Central Bank will pull first when the time comes to tighten monetary policy. The UK Central Bank is set to own half the conventional gilts in issue, and the Central Bank said this week that officials will need to tighten monetary policy modestly in coming years, and that points to a slow-burning headache for the British Finance Minister. It means a gradual increase in interest rates and eventually unwinding holdings of that £900 billion of government bonds bought under a programme of quantitative easing to stimulate the economy, and one which was so criticised by a recent House of Lords report. Officials led by Governor Andrew Bailey have signalled that they want interest rates higher than their current level before selling off some of the government bonds they've built up through their quantitative easing programme. Adopting negative rates as a potential policy tool could allow them to bring forward the moment when they scale back their bulging balance sheet. And they also could prepare the ground for bolder action. It makes sense for them to come out and let the market know what their new guidance is sooner rather than later, said John Rafe, head of UK and European rate strategy at UBS Group. The simplest thing, he said, would be for the Bank of England to lower the 1.5% threshold on where rates should be before bond sales start, a possibility if there's acknowledgement that rates may slip into negative territory. Just remember, borrowing in the UK is still financing almost one in every £4 of public spending. And there were some positive signs in the week with the European second quarter earnings season, which has been generally positive so far. For example, Taylor Wimpey in the UK, stocks rose 4.2% after the UK home builder raised its full year earnings outlook, benefiting from Britain's housing boom. while Hugo Boss stock rose 1.2% after the German luxury fashion house said it expected business to continue to rebound in the second half of the year as sales recovered to pre-pandemic levels in Britain and China in the second quarter. But Commerzbank stock fell 4.5% after the German lender recorded a second quarter loss as it continues with its major restructuring involving hundreds of branch closures and 10,000 job cuts. The bank also announced it would write off 200 million euros in the quarter, abandoning a project to outsource securities settlement to HSBC. The result was an outlier from most of the European banking sector, which had generally beaten expectations this quarter thanks to reserve releases and economic reopening. Rolls-Royce stock rose 1.8% after the British engine maker agreed to sell its Norwegian ship engine business Burgent to UK Langley Holdings for around $130 million. And in Switzerland, the mystery over the recent rally in pharma giant Roche Holding was cleared up as SoftBank revealed it had taken a $5 billion stake in the company. Roche stock has risen by over 25% since May and added another 0.9% in early trade during the week. And in economic news, the Eurozone July services PMI data rose slightly from the previous month, but came in just below expectations. Takeovers of British companies hit a 14-year high by value in the first 7 months of 2021, with no sign the buying spree is slowing after US companies targeted a leading supermarket and defence groups. The total value of UK deals in the 7 months was $198 billion, a more than threefold increase on the same period last year, which included the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Deals involving a British target totaled $34.9 billion in July, 5% less than the June number, but more than seven times the value in July 2020. The increase has coincided with the British economy's faster than expected rebound from the coronavirus crisis and reduced Brexit uncertainty since leaving the European Union. British companies have been relatively cheap compared with US rivals when measured on a price-to-earnings ratio, with the FTSE 100 trading at 15.6 against 26.9 for the S&P 500. The FTSE 250 index of mid-cap companies is trading at 9.9 times. One of those FTSE 250 constituents would be about to leave after defence and aerospace company Meggitt agreed to a £6.3 billion takeover by US rival Parker Hannifin on Monday last week. And Britain's fourth largest supermarket group, Morrisons, has also agreed to be bought for the same price by the SoftBank-owned Fortress Group and could yet receive a counterbid from CD&R. The UK takeover spree continues to move at pace, with yet another FTSE 250 stock receiving a bid, said AJ Bell Investment Director Russ Mould, after Muggett recommended the takeover. UK stocks have long been considered cheap, and this year's M&A spree shows that overseas investors have finally got enough confidence to pounce on opportunities after years of showing little interest in the market. One deal that completed in the first half of 2021, boosting M&A numbers, was the $11 billion purchase by National Grid of Western Power Distribution, England's largest electricity distribution business. Across Asia, the Shanghai closed at 3,458 on Friday, down 0.24%, despite the China Caixin Service PMI reporting stronger than expected, rising to 54.9 from 50.3. This lifted the composite to 53.1 from 50.6. The market's focus is elsewhere. First, China is experiencing its broadest outbreak of the virus, and lockdowns are likely to spur downward revisions in growth. Nearly half of China's 32 provinces are reporting cases, and travel is being discouraged. The economic impact is reinforcing expectations for additional policy support. And second, after appearing to be like the proverbial bull in the China shop, Beijing appears to have softened rhetoric about the video game sector without backtracking on the underlying criticism. In Japan, the Nikkei 225 was up 0.33% to 27,820, as this week's Japan's service PMI was revised to 47.4 from the preliminary estimate of 46.4, but remains below the 50 boom-bust level and is weaker than the 48 reading in June. This put the composite at 48.8, not 47.7, but slightly lower than the June's 48.9. Worries about the virus and the decline in US and European yields helped drag the 10-year Japanese government bond yield below zero for the first time this year. However, activity in that benchmark is pretty uneven and low, so it may not mean that much. And while we're on PMIs, Australia's service and composite PMI were unchanged from the preliminary readings of 44.4 and 45.2. In June, the service PMI was at 56.8 and the composite stood at 56.7. The central bank's decision to proceed with tapering its bond purchases starting next month appears to look past the implications of the weak data, assuming a strong recovery when the lockdown is lifted, but it could last for the rest of the month, or worse. The S&P ASX 200 jumped 2% to 7,538 this week and rose 0.4% on Friday. The benchmark index reached multiple record highs through the week, finishing Friday's session at a new intraday and closing high. Shares and bonds seem to be telling us a contradictory story, with bond markets seemingly more worried about the threat of growth from COVID-19's Delta variant, but shares just powering on, said AMP Capital's chief economist Shane Oliver. The broader market was buoyed by an outstanding 5 days for Afterpay shares, which surged 36.6% to $132.15 following Square's takeover bid for the buy now, pay later company. Its rival Zipco also benefited, jumping 16.4% to $7.70. The big four banks also supported the market's gain, with Commonwealth Bank adding 3.8% to $103.75 in the week. National Australia Bank climbed 2.7% to $26.69. ANZ rose 2.4% to $28.50. And Westpac advanced 2.2% to $25.12. News Corp climbed 11.2% to $35.20, having reported its most profitable year since the new business was created in 2013. But REA Group ended the week 1.8% lower at $159.42 after falling on Friday, following concerns about its outlook moving into financial year 2022. This is despite it posting a net profit of $313 million for the 2021 financial year and record dividends. The S&P ASX VIX, which measures the implied volatility, was down 2.39% to 11.12. And when it comes to the state of the Australian economy, Reserve Bank Governor Philip Lowe is a glass half full kind of guy. He says the speed of Australia's economic bounce back later this year hinges on high vaccination rates and has implored people to go and get jabbed. The central bank boss said while a double-dip recession in the second half of the year was unlikely, it could not be ruled out if the health situation deteriorated. Lockdowns covering Greater Sydney, Southeast Queensland and Victoria have sliced 0.75% off the RBA's economic growth expectations in the year to December 2021, from 4.75% to 4%. The RBA is assuming lockdowns will occur over the remainder of 2021 and into early 2022, and Sydney's stay-at-home orders will remain in place until at least the end of September at an economic cost of at least $12 billion. But Dr. Lowe reiterated the bank's glass-half-full economic assessment, noting the bounce back out of 2020 had been stronger than was ever expected, and the medium-term outlook was positive. Our central scenario is the economy will return to strong growth in 2022, with GDP increasing by a little over 4%, followed by growth around 2.5% in 2023. The bank's upbeat assessment was reiterated in its quarterly statement on monetary policy, also out on Friday, which said economic output and employment were expected to return to their previous path in early 2022. Activity will contract in the September quarter and some job losses are expected. Towards the end of this year, the economy is forecast to rebound from this setback as restrictions ease, as it has from previous lockdowns. The biggest risk is that a vaccine-resistant strain of COVID-19, then we're in a whole different world, Dr. Lowe said. Loose monetary policies will remain in place even after the risk of lockdowns subside to help drive down unemployment and put upward pressure on wages growth. The RBA wants to see inflation sustainably within its target band of between 2 and 3%. However, the bank doesn't expect this to happen for at least the next 2 years. RBA Governor Phil Lowe has adopted the British wartime policy in response to the latest spate of COVID-19 lockdowns, keep calm and carry on. And he said the bank's goal was to lower the jobless rate so firms have to compete more aggressively for workers, adding that part of that competition involved paying higher wages. That's our strategy, he said. The RBA forecast unemployment to fall to 4.25% by the end of 2022 and 4% by the end of 2023, an upgrade on its previous estimate. We broadly share the RBA's optimism about the economy over the medium term, Commonwealth Bank's head of Australian Economic Gareth Aird said, but we are more concerned about the economy over the near term and think it will take a while to regain economic momentum again once lockdowns are over. Dr. Lowe acknowledged successive lockdowns could have a negative effect on Australia's collective psychology, which could flow through to people being more risk averse. It's possible we will become more risk averse because we think this could happen again, and we tighten our belts, he said. That would delay the unleashing of the $140 billion in household savings built up during the pandemic, which the Morrison government hopes will help bolster the economic recovery. Further outbreaks of more contagious virus variants, which slow down a full economic reopening, could see unemployment remaining above 5% over the next 2 years, which would delay wages growth and subsequently result in much lower inflation and interest rates beyond 2024. In this downside scenario, restrictions on the consumption of discretionary services coupled with precautionary behaviour result in higher saving and a weaker profile of household consumption, Friday's policy statement said. And separately, New Zealand reported better than anticipated employment data. The employment rate in the second quarter fell to 4% from 4.6%, despite the small tick up in the participation rate to 70.5% from 70.4%. Employment rose by 1% in the second quarter after a 0.6% increase in quarter one. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand meets on August the 17th, and the overnight index swap implies a 25 basis point hike has been fully discounted. So expect more news on mortgage lending tightening then too. Gold futures for December delivery were down 0.3%. The Aussie US dollar was down 0.14% to 73.94. And the US dollar index futures was up 0.05% to 92.30. And finally on Friday, Bitcoin underwent a stunning short squeeze, soaring from 39,876 US to a high of 43,399 in just a matter of hours. Despite the fact that Ethereum is gaining traction following the London hard fork, as nothing compares to Bitcoin's finite 21 million coins. For the first time since May, Bitcoin has been above 43,000 US. With a massive comeback, Bitcoin has clawed its way back from the edge of bear market territory and is now challenging resistance zones towards bull market territory, they said. And this is because investors reacted to news of the crypto industry's lobbying. This is because the US Senate is to vote on an infrastructure bill that includes tax reporting revenue requirements that might have disastrous consequences for cryptocurrency products and services. The so-called crypto clause in the infrastructure bill has the industry racing to lobby for amendment, with officials having to listen as the opposition grows. Supporters in the US Senate offering clarity that miners and suppliers of crypto services would not be obliged to follow proposed US tax reporting standards that apply to crypto brokers. But again, these massive trading moves are on mere slithers of news, so expect continued volatility. So standing back, sure, get those glasses out and celebrate half full, but there are still some worrying signs below the surface.
The issue of house prices has been raised by a couple of my colleagues. According to the ABS's most recent figures, in the quarter to March, the mean price of a residential dwelling went up $39,000, which is almost twice what the average worker earned over that period. In other words, houses are rising in value more than workers are earning. The typical house is earning more by sitting still than the typical worker is earning by working. And yet your research program on housing seems a bit undercooked. You've got the occasional research discussion paper, but no kind of broader framework in which you set out the banks' views on house prices, the risks, costs, benefits of house prices. Houses are two-thirds of household wealth. Household debt in Australia is some of the highest in the world. Wouldn't it make sense to have a more formal research program and more considered analysis of house prices?
Well, it's always good to do research. I agree with you, but ultimately the main drivers of housing prices over time aren't within our control. As I said before, interest rates are pushing up housing prices at the moment, and they influence their influence is global. But in the end, if the society wants to do something about the overall level of housing prices, the solution isn't higher interest rates, is it? Now, if we had higher interest rates now, sure, housing price growth would be lower, but fewer people would have jobs and wages would be lower. So that's not an attractive trade-off, and it's certainly not one the Reserve Bank has a mandate to make. If the society wants to do something about housing prices, it's really about the value of the land embedded in each house. So we can keep doing research on that, but the tools are not within our hands. They're within the hands of governments. And it's about, as I said, urban design, planning laws, transportation, and taxation.
And of course, the question is, to what extent are central banks really on their game? And are they really in control of what's going on? They, of course, think they are. We perhaps would beg to differ. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.